calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. I'm Tom Hartman, broadcasting live on a radio station from coast to coast. It's 6 minutes after the hour, and our regular session, Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, first elected to the House in 1991. Is that right, Bernie?
That's correct.
I used to have your bio written down in front of me, and I've since pretty much memorized it. and now running for the United States Senate, the website Bernie.org. Congressman Bernie Sanders, if you'd like to speak with Bernie today, our telephone number is 1-866, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466, 1-866-440-THOM. I think of Bernie Sanders as America's congressman, and hopefully as America's senator come the 2006 elections here. But Bernie, what's on your plate?
Well, there's
today?
A lot of activity in Congress right now, Tom. This will probably be the last day before adjournment, so there's a lot of pieces of legislation flying around. Last night at about 2 o'clock in the morning, we voted on a bill that the Republican leadership managed to win by, I think, 2 votes in the middle of the night, and that was the so-called budget reconciliation bill, which is just an absolute outrage. This is legislation which would cut food stamps and nutrition programs for children and low-income people. It was legislation which included substantial cutbacks in financial aid for college students, and it was legislation which would make significant cuts in Medicaid at a time when our healthcare system is already disintegrating and more people lack health insurance. And meanwhile, either today or in a couple of weeks, after cutting $50 billion in programming for the most vulnerable people in this country, the Republican leadership is going to come back with more tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans, a proposal in which half of the tax breaks at least go to the richest 1%. So they're taking programming away from children, from college students, from people who will lose their health insurance, and they're replacing that with more tax breaks for the wealthy. And that is just, to me, not what America is supposed to be about.
At the same time, there's a headline this morning that the Senate has voted to extend expiring tax cuts.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
This is part of the whole thing.
Yeah, the House has not done that yet, but that's certainly what they intend to do. And as I understand it, and by the way, these proposals change every other minute. People are working on it. But the last that I've seen, half of the tax breaks would go to the wealthiest 1%. And that's just a continuation of giving more and more tax breaks to people who don't need it while we cut back on programs that the middle class and working families desperately need. So that's one issue that's taking place. The other issue here is I just came an hour ago from a very interesting press conference over in the Senate with Russ Feingold and Larry Craig and an interesting coalition of progressive Democrats, conservative Republicans, and we had the same folks from the House going over to the Senate to support the efforts in the Senate by Feingold and others to wage a filibuster, if necessary, against the language currently in the USA Patriot Act. The Senate had passed a Patriot Act bill, which was not what I wanted to see, but it was far superior to the disastrous bill that was passed in the House. So many of us are supporting the Senate proposals. I was especially active in Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, brought forth an amendment which won by a considerable majority, exempting libraries and bookstores from the FBI's ability to go in there without explaining why they were asking for the reading records of Americans. We won that strongly in the House, but the conferees from the House have given that up completely and are supporting very bad language in the conference committee. So what you're seeing now in terms of the USA Patriot Act is a coming together of progressives and conservatives to say, yeah, terrorism is in fact serious business. We just saw that in Jordan a week ago. And we have to protect the American people from terrorist attacks. But, and this is the important but, we can do that in a way which does not undermine the basic constitutional rights of the American people and those civil liberties that make us a free people. So that's an issue that people should be focusing on. The conferees are meeting probably as we speak. The Senate provisions are far, far better than the House provisions, not only in terms of Section 215, but in terms of what we call the sunset provisions. The House wanted, despite the House conferees, despite what the members of the House wanted. Here you have the conferees going way off the reservation.
If I may interrupt you, explain to our listeners what the word conferees means.
Right. What happens, obviously, when legislation gets passed is it gets passed in the House in one form, often in different form in the Senate. Conferees, people representing each body, come together to work out, ostensibly work out the disagreements. But what many people don't know is that, in fact, the conferees become a world unto their own and do not have to reflect what was passed in either body. So you have a situation where in the House, very strong language was passed on Section 215, and the conferees are saying, so what? That is the will of the House. We don't care. We'll do what we want to do. In terms of the sunset position, and that is when this legislation becomes reviewed, when it comes back before the bodies, and when you're dealing with constitutional issues, we should do that quite frequently. What the House said is, we want it 4 years. What the conferees said from the House is 10 years. Very bad stuff. So that's an issue that we are looking at. And obviously the continuation of the war in Iraq and the calling for an investigation here in Congress about how we got into the war, the degree to which the president distorted or ignored intelligence that came to him, and the fact that he continued to go public and make statements which he should have known, he was told, were simply not true. So, among other things, those are some of the issues that we're looking at right here.
Yeah, and with regard to the Patriot Act, these national security letters, we find out now that under the Patriot Act, the FBI used to be that if they wanted to essentially snoop on one of us, that they had to go before a judge and say, there's a good reason to snoop on this person, to break into their home, to get records about them, to get their doctor's records, their bank information, their ISP, read their emails. They used to have to prove it to a judge. That was the judicial branch of government and the FBI being part of the executive branch of government, a check and balance. Now, 30,000 national security letters. This is where the FBI essentially asks itself if it can do it.
Right.
And then it tells itself it can do it, and no judge ever looks it over.
Tom, you hit it, and you said it very well. That is exactly what the issue is. I mean, all of us want to be vigilant in protecting the American people from terrorism. But what our system of government is about, what checks and balances are about, is that it is not good enough for the executive branch or the FBI to say, I think this person is a terrorist. Okay, then you go to an independent judge, and the judge says, okay, why do you think that person is involved in terrorism? And if the government can make the case, then the judge says, okay, continue your investigation. But if the judge says, excuse me, you don't have any evidence, you're wrong. No, you cannot pry on that person's privacy rights. That's what separation of powers is about. And you're right, these national security letters give us a situation where the government simply says, we don't like this person, we're going in there. And there is no checks and balance. There is no independent judicial review. That's what Section 215 is about. That's what many of these other sections are about. And what we are fighting for is to maintain that separation of powers, maintain the need for the executive branch, the FBI, to go before an independent judiciary to make their case.
Yeah, just for our listeners, the New York Times has an editorial about this in today's paper that's really worth reading that just summarizes this very nicely and tightly. By the way, Bernie, just apropos of nothing, I suppose, other than you're being on this program regularly for quite some time now, got an email from a fellow by the name of Roddy. If he shows up at your campaign committee in Burlington, just wanted to give you a heads up. He says, I'm an Irishman living here in Yorkshire, England, and he listens to our program on the Internet. And he says, I'm actually hoping to get over to Vermont around election time, and if I make it, I will be reporting to Bernie's campaign office to make myself as available as a volunteer, with an exclamation mark.
An international effort here to get me elected.
There you go. I mean, this guy, he's serious. He says, it's interesting to note the parallels of what's happening to working class men and women in the U.S. with what's happening in the U.K.
Roddy is, I was in Germany last year. It's the same thing. The middle class is being obliterated. Poverty in, certainly in the United States, hunger in the United States is increasing. And guess what? The people on top are making out like bandits. And that is, to my mind, the most important domestic issue that we have to deal with. How do we protect the middle class, lower the poverty rates rather than see them increased, have health care for all people, protect our pensions. And to do that, I think we need just a strong grassroots movement which says to the wealthiest people in this country and corporate America, sorry, you can't continue to do what you're doing right now.
Yeah, it's got to be straightforward, and we need what is Goldsmith. Sir Goldsmith, one of the richest men in the world when he died just a few years ago, Sir John Goldsmith, he said, the economy exists to serve society. Society doesn't exist
exactly.
to serve the economy.
That's right.
And we've just got it backwards. We're talking with the Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Give us a call if you have any questions, comments, thoughts, whatever for Bernie. 1-866-440-8466. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. And taking your calls and questions, comments, thoughts, suggestions, 866-440-8466, 866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, and Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, you are live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Bernie, how are you today?
Good, Rick, how are you?
Tom.
Good.
Bernie, I had a process question, and this is not really partisan for me because, you know, although it's occurring now under Republican leadership, it seems to have occurred under Democrats as well, and I try to follow this process on C-SPAN, but for instance, the fiscal year ends September 30, correct?
Yes.
And you're operating under a continuing resolution now, and I know there's 13 appropriation bills.
That's correct.
And I know you folks take August off, and I know that policy, I guess, started way back before you had air conditioning, but it just seems to me that with 12 months to get these appropriation bills and a final budget out, why do they always go past the date, have a continuing resolution? Now they're working real hard to adjourn for Thanksgiving. They're working, like you said, until 2 in the morning. Why can't they just get this done on time?
Well, that is a question that many of us ask, especially those of us who have to stay up to 3 o'clock in the morning sometimes to vote on bills. And
sure.
When we come back and you go through a whole week and you're voting on a few post offices rather dealing with serious bills. I mean, in fairness to the leadership, of any leadership, you know, it's hard with 435 members and dozens of subcommittees to get this stuff going. But I think there is a general consensus. These guys are not doing a very good job in the budgeting time to make sure that we deal with the most important issues. We waste a lot of time here, and then we're gone a lot of time, and then we're not dealing with the people's business.
Thank you, Rick, for that call. 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, John in Seattle, Washington. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Bernie. Good morning, Tom.
Morning,
thank
Tom.
You.
Hi. On Wednesday, Tom talked about kind of a corollary to the Pavlov's dog theory about the lung-shot dog. And I'm a disappointed progressive who's been trying to get involved with Move On or other progressive things around this area. And I'm afraid that while Tom suggested we might be heading toward a society where the middle class is a bunch of one-shot dogs, people who are just scared to make a move, I think we're already there, and I just wanted to have you talk to that matter, please.
Well, I don't agree with that, John, and I think progressives don't have the freedom to be disappointed or cynical. We've got to fight back for the future of our country. I think the good news, if you like, is that in the last few months, because of maybe Hurricane Katrina, because of skyrocketing oil prices, because of disillusionment with the war in Iraq and the understanding that the president was not telling us the truth about how we got into the war, what you're seeing is people from all walks of life in all parts of this country saying, wait a second, what is going on in America? Why, when the president tells us on television every day the economy is doing so well, why do the overwhelming majority of the American people see a decline in their standard of living? Why is poverty increasing? So I think, John, that in fact there has been a very substantial turnaround in public consciousness and an understanding that the Republican leadership here is primarily concerned about perpetuating their power and representing the needs of the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations. So I am not at all unoptimistic about the future. I think, in fact, in terms of the next elections, Who knows? I mean, the elections are a year from now, and anything can change at any time. But based on what I'm seeing right now, we can see some very sweeping fundamental changes in the composition of the House and the Senate.
We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's the Tom Hartman Program. The number 1-866-440-8466. Aida in Tucson, Arizona. Am I pronouncing that right?
Hello?
Hello. You are live with Congressman Sanders.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. I'm calling from Tucson, and I just keep wondering why it is that the government does not try and go after these corporations that have outsourced our jobs as well as moved offshore to avoid paying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
There was a movement before Bush got into the White House, obviously, to try and stop some of that. And I just can't believe that they are just giving more and more to these big corporations and taking away more and more from the poorer people. I mean, it's just, it's not fair. And one more quick comment. I'd like to thank Showtime for replaying Fahrenheit 9/11, and I hope everybody will tune in and watch it.
Well, Aida makes a very important point. And she asks, why is it that the Congress not only doesn't stand up to the outrages and attacks on the middle class being perpetrated by corporate America, but in fact, why are they giving corporate America tens of billions of dollars in tax breaks and in other kinds of taxpayer subsidies? And the answer I have to tell Aida and your listeners is very simple. If you go to the Federal Election Commission reports, which is a very good website, find out who is making large campaign contributions to whom, and that will answer Aida's question. And the fact of the matter is you have the largest corporations and their executives making huge contributions to the Republican leadership, whether it is the energy industry and oil, who have contributed huge sums of money. And in return, of course, are getting corporate welfare, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry that has hosted $30 million fundraisers for the president and charges the highest prices in the world for drugs. That is the way it's going here, and that is what has got to change.
Yeah, well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. The telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And I dare to say, no, I don't think so. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Moving down the highway, you can hear the engine humming. Coming down the byways, you can motor running. See the smoke arising, though it's blowing like it's cold. You can hear the whistle screaming, moving down the road.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, 20, coming up on 25 before the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where being progressive never felt so good. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, bernie.org. Check it out. Diana in Santa Rosa, Florida, you are live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
I'd just like to say I'd like to thank the two of you for making my Friday lunches so enjoyable. And I was watching last night until the vote at the House of Representatives on the budget resolution. Mm-hmm. And if you want to know what the Republicans are really about, turn off all TV news but C-SPAN. That's what they're really about.
Well, I think Diana makes an important point. In C-SPAN, you can really hear every word of the debate rather than just the six-second soundbite with and photo opportunities. And if you listen to that debate, what you understood is that the Republicans are far more concerned about providing tax breaks for millionaires than they are in protecting the needs of some of the most vulnerable people in this country. I mean, the vote last night was really quite incredible. At a time when hunger in America is increasing, you don't cut back on food stamps and nutrition programs. When middle-class families can't afford to send their kids to college, you don't cut back on student loans. When our health care system is disintegrating, you don't take the people on Medicaid and throw them off of that program. So I think Diana is right. You learn a lot by just watching the debates.
Dave in Prineville, Oregon. Hey, Dave. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point here is that 2 weeks ago in the state of Ohio, I firmly believe that the people of Ohio voted for serious election reform in that state. Every single poll showed that the election reform bills that were on the ballot were winning by over 60%. But the morning after the election, it turns out that that they only counted 30% in favor of election reform. I want to know what Congress or what the Senate are, or what the Democrats are going to do to try to bring a little bit of order back to the electoral process, because it seems to me like the Republicans have completely hijacked it, and it doesn't matter how you vote.
Well, Dave, I would respectfully disagree with you on that. Believe me, on Tuesday, election day, the Republicans were not very happy, and I have not heard any of my colleagues from Ohio suggest that there was voter fraud on that vote. What we do know on Tuesday is in what amounts to an upset, the Democratic candidate for governor of Virginia won. In a close race, the Democratic candidate for governor of New Jersey won. And what was, I think, a very significant development, all of the initiatives being brought forth by Governor Schwarzenegger in California that he supported went down big time. So I think we just can't say that every time we lose a vote or things that we're sympathetic lose that there's vote fraud. I've not heard that from anybody in the Ohio delegation.
Yeah, although they're not using the voting machines in California, but, point taken. Harriet in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Harriet, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
I was wondering, last week, there was a measure defeated attached to Senate Bill 1042, which was one that included prisoner treatment. But it basically said it had required the Armed Forces Network to broadcast the opposing view. Right,
yes.
Now they get a steady diet,
yep,
of Rush,
yep,
Limbaugh and Dobson.
Yes.
Can this be reintroduced?
Absolutely. This is an issue. Now, maybe Tom knows more about this than I do. And again, let me say, as I do every week, everybody who's listening should be very appreciative of the work that Tom Hartman and others have done in forcing radio finally to hear a different point of view other than right-wing extremism. We owe these guys a whole lot. Now, my understanding, Tom, you may know more about this than I do, is that after a lot of going forward and going back, Ed Schultz, at least, is in fact now on Armed Forces radio. Is that correct?
I'm frankly not sure, Bernie. Over the last 4 or 5 days, I haven't been monitoring. I know he was going to be.
A few weeks ago, he was going to be. And the day that he was going to be, was the Pentagon pulled the plug on him and said, no, you can't. The last that I heard, and I may be wrong on this, was that he was back, he was going to be on the air.
Yeah.
But the caller is right. The fact that you have, Rush Limbaugh, Reverend Dobson, and other right-wingers on the air for our military people, when they're putting their lives on the line, for freedom, they should have the freedom to hear different points of view. And that is an issue that some of us are very sensitive to, and we are going to fight to make sure that Armed Forces Radio is open to all points of view.
Yeah, in fact, we had Ed Schultz on this program talking about it back when it was, a controversy, but I'm not sure how it's shaken out here. But I'll find out, and I'll let our listeners know. Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello?
Yes, you're live, Joe.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to call and thank you and Bernie for the work you do. I think it's fantastic. Also, two things. One, I don't think we're going to wrest control from the corporations, our political process, until we totally ban political contributions. Let our tax dollars cover the cost of elections. I think that's the way it should be. The other thing is, and after this I'll hang up, you can comment, but I want America to take the time and call Congressman Murtha's office and thank him for having the courage to stand up and tell the truth about the Iraqi war. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, Joe makes two very good points. What's going on right now in terms of campaigns and campaign financing should be of concern to every fair-minded American, and that is the cost of campaigns are becoming more and more expensive, outrageously expensive. And one of the repercussions of that is that people who have huge sums of money are simply saying, okay, no one else can afford to run for office, I'll run for office, and I'll make myself out a check for $5, $10, $50 million. We saw that in New York City where Mayor Bloomberg essentially bought the election. I think he spent something like $65 million. We're seeing it all over the country. Very, very wealthy people are writing themselves checks and running for office. And I want people to take a deep breath and say, is that what America's supposed to be about? We fought a revolutionary war in 1776 so that people, ordinary people, could have a say in the future of their lives, not just to be dominated by the wealthy and the powerful. What Joe is talking about is the need for real campaign finance reform and for public funding of elections, and I agree with him. And people say, oh, isn't it a terrible idea? My tax dollars are going to go to fund elections. But let me tell you something. We give tens of billions of dollars away in corporate welfare to large corporations, far, far more than it would take to run elections because of the campaign contributions these guys make. They have huge influence over the House, over the Senate, and that is, in fact, what is going on right now. You have a Congress and a White House dominated by campaign contributors, and it is bad, and it is getting worse. So I agree with Joe, and I think in terms of John Murtha, John made a very strong statement yesterday. John has a lot of respect in the House because he's a Vietnam vet. He is a fairly moderate guy. He's not a terribly progressive guy. The point that he made is that continued presence in Iraq is counterproductive, not only for the future of the U.S. military, which he cares a lot about, but for the war on terrorism. And it was, I think, an important statement to make.
And by the way, just David, our producer here, David Poole, just informs me, he spoke with Ed Schultz's producer, who says that the Pentagon tells them that Ed will be on armed forces. He's not now, and they have not given him a date.
So they're still jerking him around, huh?
Yeah, so, you know, hopefully the date won't be the day after the 2006 elections. We'll see.
I thought otherwise. I thought that by now he was on.
Yeah, but that's the latest word. Lee in Houston, Texas, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Bernie. I just want to say thanks, Tom, for the pill to get me out of the matrix, man. It really worked.
There you go. Okay, good.
I had a question for you, Bernie. I called in the past about the energy bill and how the you basically said Congress is owned by the oil companies, and
yeah.
I firmly believe that now. I watched last week on The Daily Show. They tried to bring swear in these guys from these oil executives in, and the representative of Alaska said, no way, we're not going to swear these guys in, so they can't commit perjury. And basically what they did was just lie. I was wondering if are these guys going to be held accountable, because they're obviously lying about the energy, not about attending the energy task force meeting with Cheney in 2001 to create this energy policy of $15 billion in tax breaks for them. I was wondering, are they going to be held accountable for this, or are we just going to sit back and let them do this?
Well, some of us want to hold them accountable, and I found it just very amusing that these guys were not sworn in. I have to say that I sit on the House Government Reform Committee, and to the best of my knowledge, I may be wrong on this, but to the best of my knowledge, witnesses are always sworn in. So some of us found it rather curious that in the Senate Republican leadership on that committee chose not to swear these guys in. On the other hand, I think if you commit perjury when you testify before Congress, that is a serious problem for you. In terms of the energy bill, clearly, I think most Americans know that the bill that was passed provides billions in corporate welfare for very, very profitable energy companies, which is an outrage unto itself. But even more important, we are now on the cusp of being able to break our dependency on polluting fossil fuels and move to sustainable energy. And it is just an outrage. It is just an outrage that Congress is not moving in that direction. The technology is there, whether it is solar power, whether it's hydrogen fuel cells, whether it is wind, whether it is other types of sustainable energies. We should be moving big time in those areas, and it is a tragedy that we're not.
Well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. This is our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The number 866-440-8466. So if you'd like to drop in and register your thoughts or have a question, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Truth in Broadcasting, the pill that will help you escape the matrix, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours. better working conditions. Vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore.
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our number 1-866-440-8466. And Roddy in the United Kingdom calling. Hey, Roddy, welcome. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Bernie. I heard you read out me email earlier. I just want to say to both of you, it's great to hear some progressive radio station. We don't seem to have that over this side of the Atlantic. But it just strikes me the similarities, like I said earlier. There just seems to be a contempt for working people. Men and women just seem to be, that legislation last night that went through, just attacking working people while they're giving the fat cats, tax breaks worth millions. It's just incredible.
Well, Roddy, thanks a lot for calling. And I think your point is an excellent point. What's happening in the United States in terms of the attacks on the middle class and the increase in poverty is happening in many industrialized countries. And it seems incredible to me that when we're seeing an explosion in technology and worker productivity all over the world, why it is that working people are seeing a decline in their standard of living. So I think it's great that you're calling from the UK, and I think all over the world working people have got to stand up for their rights.
Well said. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Christine in Sacramento, California. Hey, Christine, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yes, hi, both of you. You know, here in California, we just had a wonderful election day in that the boobin grabber, our governor, was unable to stick it to the working class of California. But they are trying to do something under the radar, and it's about Diebold. They're trying to certify those faulty Diebold machines. Even though the boobin grabber's chosen Secretary of State has said that he will give due deference and appoint a panel of open source voting scientists, etc., he has not done that. This Monday, of course, Thanksgiving week, they're having a rare, often canceled, so-called public hearing. It's really a sham. And I just wanted everyone to know they're trying to pull this crap in California.
Okay. Christine, by way of announcements and things, we can do that later on in the program. Do you have a question specifically for Bernie? I agree with you. These are important issues. They need to be discussed.
Well, let me just pick up on one thing that
Christine
said.
Okay, go for it, Bernie.
And everybody should, I think, appreciate that, is that Schwarzenegger was defeated in California because working people, unions, came together, became aggressively involved in the political process, and stood up for their rights. And what happened in California can happen in any state in the union where ordinary people get involved in the political process. So we want to congratulate the folks in California for doing the right thing.
Well said. Tim in Saginaw, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders. Bernie.org, his website, by the way. Hey, Tim.
Yeah, hi there. Tom and Bernie, I just wanted to bring up this and government in general on unions of America.
Yeah.
I'm a union member myself, and the FAA, particularly in my case, just blatant attacks towards the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
Yep.
Is this going to continue, or is Senate and Congress, are they planning any help for any of the unions, not just mine in particular, but...
Tim, actually, the answer is you're absolutely right. I mean, you have an administration which is strongly, strongly anti-union. You have a National Labor Relations Board which tilts very strongly to employers as opposed to workers. We're seeing a situation now where in many parts of the country it is enormously difficult for working people who want to come together in a union being able to organize because of the attacks that they're illegal attacks. Illegal interference that employers are mounting against them. So we certainly need major labor law reform in this country, which gives workers the constitutional right to freedom association and to form a union. In terms of the FAA, actually, that's an issue, Tim, that my office has been involved in, primarily with the flight specialists, which the Bush administration is trying to privatize to Lockheed Martin. A lot of these guys would lose the pensions that they had been promised, and we've been working with them. But between privatization and between attacks on the ability of unions to organize, there's no question that this administration is consistently coming down on the side of corporate America against the needs of ordinary folks.
Okay, well said. We have a caller, a little hiccup in our software. I don't have your name, but at the Electoral College, including in voter reform, your question to that, you want to let us know who you are and where you're calling from? Oh, Alan.
Yeah. Alan in Macon, Georgia.
Great. Thank you, Alan.
All right. Well, and maybe, Tom, you can give me some historical perspective on the Electoral College, but I live in a state that's probably 70% red. So when I go to the poll and vote, my vote really doesn't count. I mean, even if it's counted correctly, it still doesn't count because my state will simply vote, you know, Republican.
Yeah, so you'd
so
like to see...
So is there anything on the horizon, anything in the near future or the distant horizon, you know, as far as any type of reform on that issue?
Well, like
I'm not sure that there is a lot of discussion in the Congress on that. But, Alan, while you're on the phone, there's another issue in Georgia which is of great concern, and that is the Bush administration's working with people in Georgia in legislation which would really disenfranchise a whole lot of lower-income people in that state.
That had to do with the ID issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clearly targeted to African-Americans and low-income people, and it's just a backdoor effort to make sure that the people, when we should be trying to encourage everybody to vote, they're moving forward to try to discourage people to vote.
Well, I think that's done under the guise of a Mexican worker here is going to somehow subvert the voting,
it's a very bad idea.
Yeah. Well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks again for being with us. It's
good to be with you.
You're doing great work there in Congress. And Bernie.org, the website, check it out. And we will talk with you next week, Bernie. Hey, Bernie, by the way, you're going to be available the Friday after Thanksgiving?
I think we will, but let me get back to you.
Okay, great, because we will be doing the show live.
Okay.
So just wanted to let you know. Thanks a lot. Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Good talking with you, Bernie. So much in the news, so much coming up. Coming up in the next hour, who killed Kennedy? We got the whole story for you, all the details. Stick around. I'm serious. Stick around. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border, on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on XM Radio, on Sundays, rebroadcasting this program on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. For the next hour, this hour, we're gonna do something pretty special. We'll take your calls about this if you would like. If you have specific questions, 866-440-8466, our telephone number. And we're gonna be talking, Lamar Waldron and I are gonna be sharing with you what we've discovered, over the last 17 years, more or less, about who killed John Fitzgerald Kennedy, JFK. And the book is out. It is in bookstores now. It's available. It can be ordered online as well. Ultimate Sacrifice is the book. And Lamar, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Tom. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah. Since what, yesterday?
Well, to be talking in detail about these matters, we did a lot of work together a lot of years ago, and it's great to kind of be back on the case with you.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, let me just, for our listeners' benefit, your bio from the back of the back jacket of the book. Lamar Waldron's groundbreaking research has been cited in media outlets ranging from Vanity Fair and the New Republic to the History Channel and USA Today. That was really your research and my research, right?
Sure.
Okay. His work has been acknowledged by authors such as Anthony Summers and Gus Russo, historians like Dr. John Newman and John H. Davis, and former government investigators Gaten Fonzie and FBI veteran William Turner. Waldron received both undergraduate and graduate degrees from Georgia State University and lives in Atlanta. And I used to live in Atlanta, and you and I worked on this thing together for about 7 years, doing the research, traveling around, literally around the world. I went to Paris to try and track down one of the guys who was apparently one of the shooters in the Kennedy assassination. You and I traveled to Florida, to Texas, to Colorado, we all over the United States, and then I left Atlanta 10 years ago, and you continued this work for the last 10 years, and did the majority of the work in writing this book and putting it together, and in fact I had written the first draft, which was a novel, or two of us had, but I had done, I guess, most of the, you know, banging the keyboards on that one, and so between between the two of us, but acknowledge, you know, the majority, an awful lot of the work on this is your work, Lamar, and it's great. So let's just get right to the bottom line here. The inevitable question, who killed John Kennedy, why, and how?
Well, there's a three-part answer. The book, as your listeners should know, is 900 pages with 2,700 in notes, very well documented. But it all boils down to three very simple points, luckily, that can make this very complex story very easy for people to get their arms around. And that's that there was this top-secret Kennedy plan to stage a coup against Castro, overthrow Castro, and even invade Cuba that was set for December 1st, 1963. That was just 10 days after JFK's assassination. And that had been in the works all through the summer and fall of 1963. So that plan is different from any plan that's ever been in any book before. It was withheld from the Warren Commission, from the six later government investigating committees. So that plan is central to what happened in Dallas that day. Because that Kennedy plan was infiltrated by three of America's most powerful and ruthless godfathers, not just any godfathers. These are the godfathers that Bobby Kennedy himself told close associates, and those associates told us, and we found evidence to back it up, that these three godfathers were behind JFK's assassination.
And these three godfathers were Johnny Roselli from Chicago, Santo Trafficante from Tampa, and Carlos Marcello from Louisiana. New Orleans, actually, is where he lived, wasn't it?
Right, and he also controlled East Texas. So they were able to infiltrate this top-secret Kennedy plan. Now, they then used parts of this very secret plan that your listeners and the American public are hearing about just for the first time. They used parts of this very secret plan to kill JFK, first trying in Chicago, where Roselli's mob was based, next in Tampa on November the 18th, 4 days before Dallas, an attempt that we have for the first time in any book, and then in Marcello's territory of Dallas, they finally succeeded. But because they had linked parts of the assassination to this ultra-top-secret coup plan, Bobby Kennedy himself and other very high government officials were basically forced into a cover-up to prevent a nuclear confrontation with the Soviets just a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, a cover-up which in many ways has lasted to this day and is responsible for the lingering controversies surrounding the JFK assassination. So those three points, this coup plan, it was infiltrated by those godfathers, and they used parts of it to kill JFK. That's kind of the framework around which the book is built, and it makes it easy for people to understand what happened in Dallas. And
yeah.
So the best thing to do isn't to start talking about, you know, who was behind the Knoll and everything, which we are going to get to. You know,
yeah.
And you have some great stuff about that, but to start so that people understand this is what this coup plan was, and then here are these godfathers that penetrated it, and then the events in Dallas will make sense really to people for the very first time.
Yeah, and I remember, you know, when we were first pulling this information together and discovering that there had been an assassination attempt or one planned. It was all organized and put together and in place on November 2nd, 1963 in Chicago, Johnny Roselli's home territory. There was another one on November 18th, 1963 in Tampa. And ultimately, Jack Kennedy found out about these things.
Oh, well, yeah, he had to cancel his Chicago motorcade at the last minute. And then he was forced to go through with the Tampa motorcade, knowing that there were assailants that had not been caught in the crowd. But as people will see when we go through the three points of the story in order, he felt he had no choice but to go through the longest motorcade of his presidency in America, knowing that there were at-large assailants. But
and the reason why was because part of the whole motorcade process, part of what he was doing was trying to send a signal to
Well, and in fact, what would be good, Tom, is why don't we kind of start at the beginning, which I guess would be like May 1963, which is when the secret coup plan all came together. And then I think people will really be able to understand, you know, what was going on in Tampa and why JFK couldn't cancel that motorcade.
Let her rip. You know, it's funny, Lamar. It's normally I interview people and they tell me what's going on. And here you and I worked on this together. But still, I am most comfortable largely interviewing you here. And if that's okay with you. So why don't you just toss out here How did this start? How did this coup plan come together? This was post Bay of Pigs,
right.
Post Cuban Missile Crisis,
right.
And the Kennedys are looking back on the disaster of the Bay of Pigs, which had actually been planned during the Eisenhower administration by Richard Nixon.
Sure.
And as a as an October surprise that he wasn't able to pull off.
Right.
And Kennedy inherited this mess. And so they're saying, okay, what are we going to do? We've got, you know, Castro is becoming a political liability to Kennedy's, just like he was to Nixon in 1960. In fact, Jack Kennedy beat up Nixon for letting Castro go communist, right? And now Kennedy's got the problem. And so he and Bobby decide to do something about it.
Right. And what happens is the Bay of Pigs prisoners have all been released at that point. Nixon had blocked earlier efforts. But finally, in the fall of 62, Bobby Kennedy had started working with this Cuban exile who was a big hero at the Bay of Pigs, had been literally, you know, blown apart and put back together and had all the shrapnel in him. And this guy's name was Enrique Ruiz Williams, but he always told us to call him Harry Williams.
Right, I remember when I found Harry. I mean, it was just amazing because everybody thought the guy was dead or in hiding someplace.
And he kind of was. He wanted to keep a low profile because when we were talking to him, a lot of his associates had died. So because he had worked so closely with the Kennedys, and so if we then flash ahead to May of 1963, Harry Williams and Bobby had.
I was just going to say first, Lamar. Let's identify who Harry was with regard to the Bay of Pigs.
Sure. He was basically just a soldier at the Bay of Pigs. Distinguished himself by heroism there, and
tried to kill Castro.
Well, while he was laying gravely injured in a field hospital, Castro and this is well documented by a Pulitzer Prize winning author named Haynes Johnson and other exile authors have written about this. Harry Williams was lying on a cot, gravely injured. Blown to pieces almost, and Fidel Castro walks in to look at these defeated prisoners and is walking around, and very weakly Harry reached into his boot and pulled out a pistol and at a distance of just a few yards aimed the pistol at Castro, pulled the trigger. The gun just clicked.
Because his friends had taken the bullets out.
The reason was that his friends, Harry's friends, had been so worried he would commit suicide, they had removed the bullets from the gun. But Castro actually was kind of impressed by Harry's heroism and said, look, don't hurt this guy, you know, get him medical treatment.
Sent him back to the United States to negotiate with the Kennedys to basically get the blackmail money, as it were, to bail out, or the bail money, whatever, to get the other hostages out.
Sure.
We got to continue with the story. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. Lamar and I have written a book called Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for the coup in Cuba and the murder of John F. Kennedy, JFK. I will also take your calls if you have questions about it. Our number 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back right after this. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
From some ancient fight about the size of a fist, something thrown that had missed.
Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Welcome back. We're talking with Lamar Waldron, my co-author, and the book Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for a coup in Cuba and the murder of JFK. Lamar and I worked on this book together, it seems like 7 days a week, hours and hours every single day for 7 years, and then Lamar continued it for the last 10 years, finishing up the book, and it's out now. And Ultimate Sacrifice, the book, the website. Lamar, let's very quickly go through the months from the beginning of this plan to assassinate Castro to the assassination of John Kennedy and how they fit together over the next 6 or 7 minutes here, very quickly, month by month. And then our phone lines are filling up with people who have very specific questions, and we'll get to that and try to answer everybody's questions.
Sure. What happened was in May of 1963, Bobby Kennedy was working with this heroic Cuban exile named Harry Williams, whom you and I talked to extensively. We interviewed him a total of half a dozen times. And they developed this plan. for a coup in Cuba. Harry was contacted by this very high Cuban official, a famous hero of the revolution in Cuba, and we won't go into his name today because we don't want to get into Judith Miller situations, because even if a former U.S. asset has been dead for decades, some interpretations of national security law say it can still be a violation to name that asset. However, I can assure readers of the book, you will come away with a very good idea of knowing the kind of famous hero of the revolution that the Kennedys were dealing with. And in May of 1963, Bobby and Harry and JFK and this powerful Cuban revolutionary hero in Cuba decided to stage a coup against Castro. This is different from any plan that's ever been discussed in any book before.
And they weren't going to use the CIA to do it.
Well, the CIA only had a supporting role in it. They were actually working far more with the military after the Bay of Pigs. JFK didn't trust a lot of the CIA. So actually people like Cyrus Vance, Secretary of the Army, had a very big role in this plan. And by the way, this plan is confirmed by people who worked on the plan, who talked with us, by literally hundreds and thousands of pages of documents now in the National Archives. And so what happened was this
which, by the way, weren't out there just 5 years ago, 7 years ago, or thereabouts.
They are still trickling into the archives today.
Yeah, but I mean, essentially, when we started working on this book, nobody knew that this thing existed. We discovered its existence. Harry confirmed it to us, and then over the last 10 years, as Bill Clinton started declassifying Kennedy assassination documents, you were able to pull out of the National Archives, by FOIA request and whatnot, many of these things, because you knew what to ask for.
Sure.
That nobody else even knew existed. So we now have the documentation on this thing.
Right, which is why we first looked at doing it as a historical novel in the early 90s, because the documentation was there, even though we've had the story, we've even told it on the record, little mentions of it in Vanity Fair or at historical conferences, and it's like we told the story, then the documents were released. All these documents confirmed that
Because we had the witnesses. We had the people that we had talked with. So anyhow,
sure.
So these guys put together this in May of 63. They put together the plan to assassinate
Castro. So by June of 63, the CIA has a supporting role. They've got to get assets into Cuba to help with the plot and monitor its progress. And so they come up with their code name for their part of the plan, which your radio listeners will be some of the first people in America to hear on radio. And this is officially declassified. And that was called AM World.
But it's just been declassified in the last year, hasn't it?
Well, the first officially declassified documents I've seen were from the archives last summer. Documents have trickled out since the early 90s. But in AM World, if you go back and look at the Senate Church Committee of the mid-70s, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the Warren Commission, you will see nothing about AM World.
Because it was still a top-secret operation?
Well, like I say, it's now been officially declassified, but there could be up to a million CIA files still remaining to be declassified. So this plan comes together. The CIA has their supporting role in it, and the guidelines for it are great. They're like something out of Mission Impossible. They're literally documents that say, if the U.S. government is ever accused of complicity in this, plot, it will officially deny, any connection.
And this is where the Cuba contingency plan came in.
Well, that actually comes in a little bit later, but that was an important part because the Kennedys worried that if Castro found out about this coup plan, he might try some kind of retaliation. Now, they thought this retaliation might be some sort of terrorism, sabotage, hijack an airliner, or kill a U.S. An American official.
Now, the sense that I got back, when we were digging this stuff out and interviewing people for this was that what they were afraid of was that Castro might, assassinate the U.S. ambassador to Nicaragua or something like that.
Exactly right. And they were concerned about that. And they had discussions. They didn't have hard, 1, 2, 3 plans, but they had been looking at what would the U.S. do if the U.S.
Right. Ambassador...
So they
put together this contingency plan that basically said, federalize the area, grab the body, grab all the evidence, grab the film, shut up the witnesses, make it obscure, because the fear was that if Castro struck and, say, he did assassinate the ambassador to Nicaragua or the governor of Louisiana...
That would be the worst thing, would be that if the U.S. thought he had assassinated...
That's right. The outcry from the American people would be so great that we would then have to overtly invade Cuba, which could cause World War III.
And then what happened if it turned out to be just a domestic dispute or a simple robbery, and here we had invaded Cuba and cost thousands of lives? So So right. Those kinds of plans, the thinking behind those plans, are actually responsible for many of the lingering controversies.
Right. This is how the what looked like a cover-up first happened as a result of this specific operation. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. He and I wrote a book called Ultimate Sacrifice. UltimateSacrificeTheBook.com, the website. We'll be back with your calls and questions and the rest of this timeline right after this. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
High and low, all must go, heart to the shout of war. Leave to the women the harvest yield. Gird ye men for the sinister field, a saber instead of a scythe to yield.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, 25. Coming up on 25 before the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. I'm talking with my co-author in the new book, Ultimate Sacrifice, John Robert Kennedy, the plan for a coup in Cuba and the murder of JFK, Lamar Waldron. Lamar is in Atlanta. I'm broadcasting here live from Portland, Oregon. The book is just out now, available. It lays out the whole shooting match here, no pun intended, about how and why John Kennedy was killed and what led up to it. And also, Ultimate Sacrifice, the book, is the website for the book. Lamar, just very quickly now, we've got in May of 63, Bobby and John Kennedy and Harry Williams putting together, and this insider guy in Cuba, putting together a plan to take out Castro and install a new government. Then we're moving forward.
Right. And then the military, specifically Secretary of the Army Cyrus Vance, had a big role in it. The CIA had a supporting role. And Harry Williams was Bobby Kennedy's right arm for this coup plan. Bobby had the command and control of it.
Yeah, and Bobby was really running this thing. Jack was exactly. Sort of distant, more or less, plausible deniability at
exactly.
Some level.
He had to be protected. So Bobby was calling all the shots on this plan with the military, with the exiles, with the CIA. Now, the CIA had a supporting role, and they perhaps kind of resented that a little bit. Or they just wanted to be sure there weren't problems. So they developed, they reactivated in June of 63, all this is documented, three other plans that they had been using in recent years to try and get to Castro. One was the CIA mafia plots that our book documents for the first time, building on the work of Dan Moldea. We really document thoroughly. The CIA mafia plots to kill Castro had begun not under JFK, as some people like to claim, but they began in 1959 with the CIA and how
under Nixon, when Nixon was in charge of the Cuba project as vice president.
Right, and so the mafia had been working with the CIA since 1959 to try to kill Castro. A low-level Dallas gangster named Jack Ruby was involved in those 1959 plots.
Isn't it ironic that Richard Nixon, wanting to get somebody to take out Castro, instead of turning to the CIA, would turn to the mafia? I mean, it says something about Nixon.
Well, our book documents a lot about Nixon and the mob. A lot of people associate the Kennedys with the mafia, and there were some connections with the father, certainly, and even with John. But yeah, Nixon was very, very mobbed up, and our book really sets that record straight. So the CIA in June of 63 reinvigorates those CIA mafia plots, specifically with Johnny Roselli, the Chicago mafia's man in Las Vegas and Hollywood, who was behind-the-scenes member of the Rat Pack with Sinatra. And in fact, Roselli is kind of responsible for that scene in The Godfather with a horse's head in the bed, got the guy the role. That was based on Roselli helping Frank Sinatra get his comeback role in From Here to Eternity. So you've got Johnny Roselli working with the CIA, earlier involved in those plots were Santo Trafficante. Also involved in those plots are Carlos Marcello of New Orleans. So what happens is, when the CIA reinvigorates those plots, it's kind of a backup to the main Kennedy coup plan. They don't tell the Kennedys about this, by the way. That gives the mob entree to learn about the Kennedy plan, because the Kennedys had worked very hard to try to keep the mob out of their coup plan. But here the CIA is kind of letting the mob in the back door, thinking they're working with the mob to get Castro, but because of Bobby's intense prosecution of the mafia, the mafia has no choice.
Now, let's just take
to get rid of JFK to end Bobby's power.
Right. Just a very quick digression here. The motive for this, we're going to talk about means, motive, and opportunity.
Sure.
Marcello, for example, or I call him Marcello. I Just
I think either pronunciation, he would probably say it differently still. But
yeah, when I interviewed some of the Cubans back years ago, it was always Marcello. But in any case, it was Marcello. The story of Bobby's, I mean, essentially prior to Kennedy becoming president, there had been no functional prosecution of organized crime in the United States. Hoover had his hands tied, as it were, you know, and that whole story is in there. And the Kennedys come in, and Bobby just goes on a holy crusade against these guys.
Right.
And, for example, what happened to Marcello, if you can tell it in just a sentence or two.
Sure. It was right around the time of the Bay of Pigs when the CIA was again secretly working with the mafia to try and kill Castro. That's, again, as we have that in the book. Marcello and Roselli both were not even born in the U.S., had no right to be here. Well, in Marcello's case, Bobby put such pressure on the INS at that time, who had basically done nothing, maybe because of all the political support Nixon was getting from Marcello and his allies. So now Bobby Kennedy's attorney general and the INS, you know, like they suddenly wake up and hear the music, and they hustle Marcello on a plane, take him down to Central America, dump him off. That country gets spooked, and Marcello winds up trudging through the jungles of Central America, you know, screaming curses, you know, at Bobby Kennedy, and eventually is flown back into the U.S., according to one report by this New Orleans pilot named David Ferry. So, you know, basically Marcello had sworn a blood oath against the Kennedys.
And then he gets back and Bobby prosecutes him. In fact, trial starts the day before the first assassination attempt in Chicago.
That's right.
And it ends the day of the assassination of Jack Kennedy.
Right, so he was being prosecuted.
And he's bribed a juror in the trial.
Right, so Trafficante was being prosecuted, and Roselli's power all flowed from Sam Giancana. And Giancana was being prosecuted and shadowed. So these guys literally had no choice. They could not wait until the 1964 election. They could not wait until the coup. They literally had, you know, Jack Kennedy had to die to end Bobby's power immediately. So the CIA, though, in working with these mobsters to try and kill Castro, they got their backdoor entrance entree into the Kennedys' coup plan, and they basically compromised each aspect of it. If Harry Williams was Bobby's right arm for the Cuba plan, there were five exile leaders who were, as Harry Williams told us, with his five fingers on his right hand. And each of those five fingers were compromised by the mafia. And we have the smoking gun documents in the book where Roselli's Chicago mafia pays one of those Cuban exile leaders, Tony Verona, $200,000 in August of 1963. This is a CIA document from the
Army. Lamar, pardon my interrupting you, but you know we're running out of time, and we're still at a level of minutia, and we still haven't gotten to our callers, and we still haven't had an opportunity
to lay out who did
the shooting and why.
Sure. Well, let's get to the actual assassination attempt. So you have these three godfathers from Chicago, Tampa, and Texas and Louisiana. And so they first tried to kill JFK in Chicago on November 2nd. Pierre Salinger, JFK's press secretary, told us about Jack Ruby being in Chicago a week before that, getting a $7,000 payoff. And we have all the details on that in the book for the very first time. However, the Secret Service found out that there were four men in Chicago who were planning to shoot the president. And I've talked to Secret Service agent in Chicago at the time, Abraham Bolden, about this. There's a lot of new documentation about this in the book. And so the Kennedys found out, and they literally, that there were four men on the loose who were trying to kill JFK. And they thought, and a couple had the suspects seemed to have Hispanic names. And so what to do? Had Castro found out about the coup plan? Didn't know. So it literally at the last minute, they canceled not just the motorcade, but JFK's entire trip and Pierre Salinger.
Yeah, we've already told the folks about that.
Right.
So let's bring us right up to the day of the assassination.
Well, let's flip in November 18th, which was the next time, and that was in Tampa. And as we have talked earlier, that's when JFK found out about that attempt, but he was giving a speech that night with words written by the CIA for the leader the coup leader in Cuba. So he couldn't cancel that motorcade again, not so soon after Chicago, not when he was supposed to be giving a speech of support to this big famous Cuban revolutionary in Cuba through his speech. So he continued that. So then that brings us to Dallas. And I think I should let you talk about what Dave Powers, one of JFK's closest aides, told you.
Yeah, Dave Powers and Kenny O'Donnell were in the car right behind Jack and Jackie, and I interviewed Dave in the Kennedy Library, And in fact, I sat down and he said, I was sitting in a rocking chair opposite his desk, and he said, that rocking chair was Jack Kennedy's rocking chair. I'm like, whoa. So anyhow, he said, I said, what, you know, what happened on November 22nd, 1963? And he said, well, we were in the car. Kenny and I were in the car. He says, I saw the muzzle flash in front of me. I saw the shot fired at the car and heard the blast and saw the thing hit Jack. And Kenny reaches over and grabs my leg and yells, you know, we're driving into an ambush. And I said, and this I'm paraphrasing here. We've got all the tight languages in the book. And I said, essentially, did you try and tell the Warren Commission about this? And he said, yeah, but, you know, every time I tried to, you know, when they were taking my deposition, every time I tried to say anything, you know, Jerry Ford would interrupt me. And so, you know, on it went. So
have that story in the book and the role of Arlen Specter noted for the first time in the book about this day, Powers. And so what you had in Dallas, as Tom had said, you definitely had shooters from behind the fence on the grassy knoll, and there are witnesses that saw two individuals back there. And then you had witnesses who saw two individuals in the upper floors of the school book depository. And what we're going to do when we come back from break, we'll explain who those people were, why they were there, what happened, and then why Bobby Kennedy himself realized instinctively, literally within a couple of hours, who was behind his murder. And he told that to a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who was with Harry Williams, and why Bobby Kennedy had to control the cover-up that actually started in many ways at the autopsy that night.
And how Harry basically laid this all out to us, and the reason why Bobby was doing the terrible irony, number one, Bobby thinking that he had paid for the murder of his own brother, and number two, that he had to cover the thing up to prevent World War III from happening. And
exactly.
This is absolutely mind-boggling. We'll be back with Lamar Waldron. He and I wrote a book called Ultimate Sacrifice. It's just released this week. It's in bookstores and online. We'll be taking your calls. 440-8466. It's 45 minutes past the hour. And welcome back, my friends.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It really doesn't matter what anyone thinks, we just keep guzzling.
Now and welcome back, my friends. 50 minutes past the hour, 9.5 minutes before the top of the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We're talking with Lamar Waldron, Ultimate Sacrifice, the book, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for a coup in Cuba, and the murder of JFK. And Lamar, can you stick around for another hour?
Sure.
Okay, because I think this thing really really deserves it. There is so much detail here. I mean, it took us 900 pages to lay the whole thing out for our readers. The least we can do is give it 2 hours on this radio program. And this will be the one and only time we do it. It'll be in the archives at White Rose Society. People can read it. We've got a whole bunch of callers. I know that there'll be more once it starts. People will have questions. So ask the folks who are on hold. If we can't get to your questions in this hour, hang on. We'll get to them in the next hour. And so here we are now. We've got the plot unfolding. I frankly don't remember where exactly we were at what point in time when we were.
You had just described what Dave Powers, one of JFK's closest aides, told you that he and Kenny O'Donnell in the limo behind JFK had witnessed.
Right. The bottom line, there were shooters obviously in the sixth floor, and at least two at the same time. By the way, Oswald's down on the second floor having lunch.
Right. And there were the two shooters that witnesses saw behind the grassy knoll. And what you said, I do want to point out one thing, because the Secret Service, didn't behave perfectly, but they've taken a lot of unnecessary flack. And when Dave Powers told you, what he and Kenneth O'Donnell realized, that they were driving into an ambush, the shots were coming from the front, that explained for the first time why the driver of JFK's limousine, the Secret Service agent,
why he slowed down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You would not speed up if you're driving into an ambush.
Right. And the driver, if he thought that he was being shot at from behind, which is where the school book depository was at that point in the motorcade after they had started to make that turn, if he thought he was being shot at from behind, he would speed up. Instead,
right.
he slowed down.
So he did
enduring questions.
Right.
So,
he did what he should have done.
So the four people who were on the ground shooting.
Sure. Sure. Okay. Now, there are four people that a lot of evidence shows were in Dallas that day. Okay. One was Johnny Roselli himself. The first two attempts had not worked in Chicago and Tampa. Usually a top mafia godfather, you know, would delegate down the line and would remain very insulated. We know this because Bobby Kennedy testified to Congress about that. So usually the mob bosses were very well insulated. However, the first two attempts had not worked. This was maybe their last chance to use that motorcade plan they had also wanted to use in Chicago and Tampa. So Roselli, there are, I would say, it's not conclusive, but there's enough evidence that it looks like there's a very high probability Roselli was actually in Dealey Plaza that day. Now, another individual whom witnesses place in Dealey Plaza that day is Chicago hitman Charles Nicoletti. Nicoletti had been caught just a year earlier in Chicago with a specially modified hit car. This is in congressional testimony.
This is like something out of a James Bond movie.
Exactly.
Secret in fact, Department. It was probably James Bond movies that inspired it.
Oh, and that was all the craze at the time.
Yeah.
And so this special hit car had secret compartments and radio equipment and place-side, you know, guns. And none of the cars, by the way, parked behind the grassy knoll, behind that picket fence was a big parking lot. None of those cars were searched that day. So there's Charles Nicoletti, good friend of both Johnny Roselli and Nusana Trafficante, and Nicoletti, like Roselli, was working on those CIA mafia plots to kill Castro at that time. Also,
so these guys knew about the Cuba contingency plan. They knew that if an assassination happened and they could convince the government that Castro had something to do with it, that the government would then have to kick in to gear and cover the thing up.
Well, and even at one stretch beyond that, we now know that the CIA mafia plot they were specifically looking at, and this may have also been part of the way the coup leader in Cuba was going to kill Castro, involved shooting Castro in an open Jeep when he was on his way to his beach
right.
house in Varadero Beach.
So we only have 2 minutes left
sure.
in this hour,
okay.
Lamar's.
So the other, the third person in Dallas who was deported the next day was Michael Victor Mertz, the creator of the French Connection drug smuggling operation as depicted in the film. Famous French assassin, had saved de Gaulle's life, had gone from being Nazi collaborator in World War II to machine gunning a bistro full of Nazis and winning the French Legion of Honor. An incredible real-life figure, and he was deported from Dallas the following day. Notorious assassin and part of a heroin ring that involved Trafficante and Marcello.
Right, that was made into the movie The French Connection. This
right.
is the guy that I tried to track down in France, and boy, when I got into the neighborhood where he
right.
was living and started talking to people in that neighborhood, you never saw people shut up and run away so fast in your whole entire life.
And this is a very nice neighborhood because Mertz did very well after the assassination.
Oh, the Duchess of Windsor lived there.
Right, right. And the fourth person, whom we don't name in the book, but you learn a lot about him, was a Cuban exile CIA operative who was working on the coup plan. So those were the people there. Now, and Bobby Kennedy, you know, realized that the plan they were going to use against Castro had been used on his own brother. So just a few hours after the assassination, Bobby Kennedy calls Harry Williams, who had been in Washington, had been meeting with high CIA officials. Harry was getting ready to go in to Cuba the next day to meet with the coup leader to await.
Because they were going to kill Castro in a week. We have less than a minute, Lamar.
Right.
And Harry Williams gets this phone call, or Harry Haynes Johnson gets this phone call, and it's Bobby on the other end saying,
one of your guys did it. And we say in the book, we explain why Bobby told that to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Haynes Johnson and not to Harry Williams, and it was because Bobby recognized the plan, and Haynes Johnson was working with one of Bobby's Cuban exile leaders who had been co-opted by the mafia, according to CIA documents.
Right, which brings us to Lee Oswald and brings us to the whole Patsy thing, and we'll have to deal with all that in the next hour. Plus, we'll be taking your calls on this. We've got about 15 seconds here, Lamar.
Well,
Final point, and
keep in mind, Bobby controlled the autopsy, JFK's autopsy. So all the controversy at the autopsy were due to Bobby Kennedy. Dave Powers and Kenny O'Donnell were with Bobby up on the 17th floor at Bethesda, the autopsy downstairs. And so, you know, Bobby.
And he was controlling it by telephone, basically.
Exactly right.
By remote control.
And Bobby knew what Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers had seen at that point.
Yeah, so he knew that something bad had happened, that he thought, you know, Castro might have been involved, he thought that his plot had gone wrong.
Exactly.
Trying to shut this thing down and cover this thing up until we can figure out what's going on here. And then LBJ says the same thing to Earl Warren. We gotta put a lid on this thing for a while, make people think it was just this lone nut. And the reason why is because if word either of our plot gets out, or if word gets out that Castro was behind this, if either one of those two things happens, it could start World War III and
exactly.
And all life on Earth, because these two giant nuclear arsenals were pointed at each other just months after the Bay of Pigs invasion, or after the Cuban Missile Crisis. We'll be back with more in just a minute. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We're talking today with my co-author in the book Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, The Plan for a Coup in Cuba and the Murder of JFK, Lamar Waldron. And Lamar on the line with us. Lamar, we in the last hour. Let's just summarize the entire hour in less than 2 minutes, and then I want to get to our callers because I know where that's going to take us. And we've also got folks in the chat room tossing me notes here. I think that I don't remember if you were with me or not when we first came across this document at 1:45 p.m. Mr. George Herbert Walker Bush, president of Zapata Offshore Oil Drilling Company, Houston, Texas. Telephonically furnished the following information. Bloody, remember that?
So, well, let's save that for a little bit later.
Yeah, we chose not to include. Well, in any case, we'll get to that. So we've got here's the story in short form. There's a plan. There's three separate attempts to assassinate Jack Kennedy in November in Chicago, in Tampa, and in Dallas. The third one obviously successful. The Kennedys, 6 months earlier, had put together, a little more than 6 months, about 6 months earlier, had put together a plan with Harry Williams, Harry Enrique Ruiz Williams, and a Cuban leader, a guy who was going to take over run Cuba, whatever, to assassinate Fidel Castro. And this plan got, because there was some CIA folks involved and who were connected with some mob folks, this plan got infiltrated by the mafia. And they used some of the people from this plan to assassinate Kennedy. And that then caused Bobby to have to go into cover-up mode, both to keep the plan secret and also to keep the American people from thinking that maybe Castro had killed Kennedy, thus producing an outcry for a response that would possibly lead to World War III.
Right. And this just forced all sorts of cover-ups on the part of Bobby Kennedy and on the part of Lyndon Johnson and the Warren Commission. And, you know, nobody could look too hard. And the Warren Commission was not told about AM World, the CIA's part of the Kennedy's coup plan. And so you just see how all these cover-ups develop. And even Bobby Kennedy, you know, had to keep a lot of information under wraps. Now, the mafia had to keep information under wraps, too, because the American public rumors of the Chicago attempt had circulated among some news people and even reached the Warren Commission, but just rumors. Nobody knew anything about the Tampa assassination attempt. Just two tiny articles appeared the weekend after JFK's death. Nothing appeared at the time. The Kennedys had made sure of that. So the mafia had to make sure the Warren Commission never got confirmation of Chicago or heard about Tampa.
And when we say the mafia, by the way, for people who are just tuning in,
sure.
When we say the mafia, we're talking about Johnny Roselli, who was a mob leader in Chicago, worked with Sam Giancana, Carlos Marcello in Louisiana and Texas, and who ran basically from New Orleans all the way to Dallas and everything in between and all around, Santo Tropicante in Tampa, who basically ran Florida and who had been the guy involved in the actual. The thing that they made the movie the French Connection about, among
right.
other things, you know.
And so when Secret Service agent, Chicago Secret Service agent Abraham Boland, who had been the first black presidential Secret Service agent in U.S. history, in the spring of 64, he realized not only did the public not know or the news media not know about the Chicago and Tampa attempts, the Warren Commission didn't know. So he made arrangements to go to Washington to meet with somebody on the Warren Commission staff and tell them about Chicago and Tampa, those attempts. Because, you know, there's no way you could blame the assassination on just poor little Lee Harvey Oswald, if there were these other two attempts, Oswald didn't even own a car or drive. How could he be, you know, so...
He didn't even have a driver's license.
Right.
In fact, he was arranging to get one in the weeks before this all happened.
Right. And so what happened was Bolden was framed by the Chicago Mafia. And we named the people specifically in the book. One of them was Richard Kane, the number two man in the Cook County, Chicago Sheriff's Department, who was also a made member of the Mafia, and was working for the CIA on the CIA Mafia plot, had infiltrated...
To kill Castro.
Right, and had infiltrated the Kennedys' coup plan. We have the CIA documentation on that. And he used one of his goon thugs, Sam DiStefano, to get a couple of low-level crooks to perjure themselves against Bolden. One of those crooks later admitted he perjured themselves, but poor Abraham Bolden, clean-cut, straight-laced, great Secret Service agent, sent to prison for six
to this day, still Abraham Bolden still trying to get his reputation
That's
back.
That's correct.
And in fact, one of our goals in publishing this book is to try and help him get his reputation back, because he certainly, I mean, he tried to do a noble thing, but the Warren Commission did what they were asked to do, and all of them, everybody who served on it, very well rewarded. One of them was made president of the United States, another was made a U.S. senator, so on. They said, no, we can't allow this to come out. We've got to cover this thing up in order to prevent World War III.
Right, and it's unclear, you know, who on the Warren Commission knew why. Obviously now, you know, people like Earl Warren and even Gerald Ford has said, well, you know, off the record I was told about some of these efforts. And, of course, Alan Dulles on the Warren Commission had been head of the CIA when the CIA Mafia plots were happening. So different people on the commission knew different things. And I guess the bottom line is this cover-up was so successful of both the Kennedy coup plan and the assassination attempt that while Bobby Kennedy would tell people in private, Marcello killed his brother, and then eventually they learned that Trafficante was involved, and then also Roselli. You know, it wasn't something they could do in public. Bobby could not do anything in public about Bolden. I talked to one of his associates who said, look, you know, Bobby knew about Bolden's case, but he couldn't do anything about it. And I had just been talking.
Because it might blow this thing.
Right.
So we've basically laid this thing out,
sure.
Lamar. And I'd like to go to the phone lines and let's
sure.
just take some phone calls and see what, you know, let some folks try and punch some holes in this or ask some questions of us. Wayne in Seattle, Washington, you're live and on the air with Tom Harbin and Lamar Waldron. Hey,
Hi,
Wayne,
Tom.
Welcome to the program, and thanks for holding so long.
No problem. I'd like to ask a real quick yes or no question, then more on the subject matter.
Yes, sir.
First of all, would either one or both of you be willing to engage in a moderated debate with other researchers?
Lamar?
Well, let me let you know this. Tom had mentioned I was in Atlanta, which is where I live. I'm actually in Dallas right now, and at 5 o'clock Central Time, I'll be giving the first full public presentation about our findings at the JFK Lancer Conference, which is full of many noted experts and researchers, and I've been in touch in recent days with many researchers at another conference in Washington. So we work a lot with other researchers, and we feel that once these researchers have read the book and looked at the documentation, which is what we encourage everyone to do because so much in the book is new and has never been in any book before, but is all from the National Archives, you know, we're happy
not
to talk to
it,
other research.
Much of it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, a presentation is not a moderated debate. Would you be willing to engage in a moderated debate with other researchers?
Sure. With anybody who has read and looked at this documentation, we'd be happy to. You know, if they haven't read the documentation or read the book, you know, it's hard to debate someone if they don't know, you know, where you're coming from.
Right.
If you
well,
can
there are
see
a lot of books out, a lot of authors. I'm sure you've come across the works of Jim Fetzer, Vincent Palomara, and Fletcher Prouty. And
we cite Vince Palomara extensively, and I sent him a copy of the book last week, and Vince has been a big help.
I'm just curious, how did the Mafia get the Secret Service to stand down in Dallas, especially after two previous attempts, so many procedures were violated. The motorcade came to a almost complete stop. It slowed below procedures, and none of the windows in the buildings were shut down. There were no Secret Service agents stationed on top of buildings. Secret Service agents were out in Fort Worth drinking until the wee hours of the morning the night before. There were no agents on Kennedy's car. The flatbed truck for the press that was normally in front of the presidential limousine had been moved to the back of the motorcade. How did the Mafia get all of these things done?
Well, we address that in the book in many ways. And I'll address as many of your points as I can, and if I don't hit them all, remind me, and I'll address those too. I used to work in government, and you know, they're written procedures that you have in a lot of rule books, and then they're how those are actually
Lamar,
applied.
Let's just do it very tightly. We've got 1 minute before we got to take a break. I'd like you to answer Wayne's question so we can get to others.
And when you look at other motorcades, and see, that's what we've done. We didn't just look at Dallas. We looked at all the other motorcades. You find a lot of procedures routinely were not followed for those either. And there were.
So just because something was written down in a book and this is the procedure doesn't mean that anybody ever bothered to follow it.
And also, unlike Chicago and Tampa, actually the agents were taking kind of a sigh of relief in Dallas because they weren't in the
because they thought Tampa was where the shooting was going to happen.
Right, and so they did kind of let their guard down somewhat in Dallas because they had just been through this intense effort there, and there were some security precautions. That we don't think have been made public yet because they were tied into this coup plan. And actually, when we come back from break, I will tell you about some Secret Service document destruction that our caller does not seem aware of that Tom and I may have actually inadvertently sparked. So there's a lot about the Secret Service in our book, and I highly recommend the work of Vince Palomara, who has talked to a lot of Secret Service agents.
We'll be back with that and your calls. Right after this, we're talking with Lamar Waldron. The book is Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for coup in Cuba and the murder of John F. Kennedy. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least clean elections and the ability of a Democratic president or a Democratic former attorney general or the ability of a Democratic preacher from Atlanta to not be assassinated. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, 22 minutes past the hour, more or less. And we're talking with Lamar Waldron. Lamar and I wrote a book called Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for coup in Cuba and the murder of JFK. And Lamar, let me very quickly just summarize for folks who are just tuning in the basic premise of the book. John Bobby Kennedy had a secret plan to overthrow Castro and invade Cuba on December 1st, 63. That was about a week after Jack was assassinated. Never been revealed before. We lay it out in the book. We've got the documents to prove it. Number two, three mafia godfathers who were being prosecuted. They were on the verge, all three of these guys, of just, you know, facing the rest of their lives in prison as a result of Bobby Kennedy coming down on them. And these were, like, serious guys. Johnny Roselli, Santo Traficante, and Carlos Marcello had found out about this plan that John and Bobby were doing to assassinate Castro, infiltrated it, and used some of the very people in that plan to assassinate Kennedy, rather, or at least to make it look like those people had assassinated Kennedy. And that then sparked this enormous cover-up by the government, both to protect the plan and to prevent World War III. One point that you wanted to make to our last caller about the Secret Service, Lamar,
right.
And then we're going to go to the next caller.
Sure. And that's why that even though the Secret Service violated procedure and was far from perfect and agents had a habit of going out drinking, especially when they thought they were past the most dangerous part of JFK's schedule for November, that doesn't mean they were involved in any way in the assassination. To give you a great example, when Tom, you and I had submitted some written testimony to the JFK Assassination Records Review Board in November 1994 for their Dallas hearing, and it revealed for the first time to them this attempt to assassinate JFK in Tampa on November the 18th. Another gentleman from Tampa, Frank DeBenedictis, also submitted written testimony. So we know that by late November 1994, the JFK Assassinations Records Review Board, created by Congress, appointed by President Clinton, knew about that Tampa attempt. Now, they were supposed to find the records and release them. That's what they were mandated to do. Apparently some efforts were made in that regard. Somebody may have called the Secret Service, say, you got any records, maybe Tampa, Chicago? Well, after the official request was made in January, in January of 1995, just about 5 or 6 weeks after, our written testimony informed the review board about the Tampa attempt, the Secret Service came back to the review board and said, last week we destroyed those records. in violation of the act. But again, that wasn't to cover up Secret Service involvement. It was because Tampa had been kept secret at the time because of the secrecy surrounding the Kennedy's coup plan, and that secrecy has never been officially lifted in many ways, even today, and certainly not in 1995.
In fact, large parts of that operation are still secret. Moving along, Dick in Seattle, Washington. You're live with Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Well, Tom, I'm a little skeptical about this book. It sounds like it's another The Mob Did It cover-up book like Contract on America, but made more legitimate by incorporating, you know, the well-proven conspiracy theories, which, as you know, were all attacked and still are being attacked by the establishment media, most notably at the time by Time Life's Henry Luce, who was a CIA asset, who bought and covered up the Zapruder film. That's actually a C.D. Jackson who worked for, he headed up, I believe it was Time magazine, and he was a CIA agent himself. And Arthur Sulzberger, of course, is the New York Times, who promoted the Warren Commission cover-up. But it sounds like it ignores the fact that the mob was employed by the CIA through Robert Mayhew's liaison from Hughes Corporation, and they were employed by the CIA for hits, mostly domestic, including apparently JFK's. And it was called Operation Mongoose under CIA's William Harvey, who was a visceral Kennedy hater, and you know, the mob or RFK could not control the military autopsies, medical and X-ray fraud at Bethesda. As you imply here, I think that's overreaching.
We actually have evidence he was right there doing it.
I know he was doing it, but he didn't do the X-ray fraud. And he couldn't control all the people involved in that, and he wasn't involved with the CIA's hit on Commander Bruce Pitzer, who photographed it. I was going to expose those photos.
Let's just pause right there for a second, Dick, and Lamar.
Sure.
Why don't you respond to what Dick
has
said so far, and then we'll let Dick finish up.
Sure, the book explains all of those points, and we should keep in mind, you know, Bobby Kennedy knew more about this plan. Bobby Kennedy was America's, really, the biggest mafia buster ever. I mean, when it's Bobby Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy's people saying, you know, the mafia did it, the mafia killed my brother, I think that carries an awful lot of weight compared to, you know, to a lot of people who weren't there, you know, and who weren't in the trenches and who don't know the stuff that's still secret. A million CIA documents, a government official admitted, and a report anyone can find online at ombwatch.com or .org, are still secret. So it's Bobby Kennedy saying this and his close associates. It's not something that just researchers came up with.
Well, we know what he said. Haynes Johnson told us. He said that he was one of our guys, and he was talking about the CIA Operation Mongoose.
Sure. Well, if you'd like to finish, I'd love to address your other points. You know, and the mafia godfathers we're talking about, they were bigger than General Motors. I mean, it was a multi-billion-dollar-a-year organizations. And so to think that they're, you know, just taking orders from the CIA or from lower-level CIA agents, it's just not worn out.
We're out of here. We'll be back in just a minute. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Living in the future in a plastic dome sounds mighty strange, I agree. But now I call it home, sweet home, that's where I long to be, yeah. Living in the future in a plastic dome.
I don't think so. I just don't think so. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, 20, coming up on 25 before the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. The live chat room, if you want to drop in, just go to tomhartman.com and click on live chat. And Lamar, just wrapping up your answer, there are a lot of people who are very wedded to the idea that the CIA was responsible for the death of Kennedy. And they believe that when Haynes Johnson got that call from Bobby, you know, one of your guys did it, that he was talking about Operation Mongoose.
Well, Mongoose officially ended in late 1962. It was a failure. It didn't do anything but perhaps help provoke the Cuban Missile Crisis. So there's a lot of misinformation out there about these Cuban operations. And the book, luckily, one reason it's 900 pages, it corrects and adds to a lot of that information. And the CIA, the highest levels of the CIA, keep in mind, they knew that the U.S. was getting ready to overthrow Castro with an invasion, if necessary, after Castro's death, when the U.S. troops would be invited in by the new government. They knew that was coming up on December 1st. So at the highest levels of the CIA, they would have known that killing JFK on the very day Harry Williams was meeting, Bobby's aide was meeting with these CIA officials and getting ready to go into Cuba to await this coup, that would have brought all that to a halt. I think most people in the CIA wanted to see Castro overthrown. Now, were there some lower-level Cuban people, perhaps on the level of CIA operations chief in Miami, David Morales, who was very close to Johnny Roselli? You know, the evidence is pretty extensive that he had some involvement, whether it was knowing or unknowing, whether he was manipulated or not. At that level, the book outlines a lot of evidence. So we're not saying
evidence of what?
Well, that he had some involvement, but again, he was close to Johnny Roselli. They went out drinking a lot. He was working with Johnny Roselli on the CIA mafia plot. So,
right.
You know, how much?
And this is where it gets all mixed up because Nixon had brought the mob into the CIA programs back in the late 50s and early 60s to assassinate Castro.
Sure.
And they'd basically been hanging out there ever since.
Right. So when the CIA got reports that Johnny Roselli's Chicago mafia had, for instance, paid off one of Bobby Kennedy's Cuban exiles $200,000, well, to the CIA, that's two of their allies, Cuban exiles, mafia, working together against Castro. Big deal. In hindsight, that's a huge smoking gun because of another memo that talks about that exile removing obstacles and that sort of thing. So a lot of the CIA's cover-ups are due to, you know, there are bureaucratic failures, intelligence failures, lack of cooperation with other agencies. They were doing these other plots on the side as a backup. They appeared to backfire. And there were some lower-level CIA people. And Morales, not exactly what I call lower-level, but he's not a high Washington
right.
official.
Yeah.
And so the book makes all that clear and outlines all the evidence so people, for the first time, have all the evidence to make the decision for themselves.
The book is titled Ultimate Sacrifice, and it's written by Lamar and me. Diana in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Diana, you're live with Lamar and I.
Okay, thank you. And, Tom, I love you. I think you're just great.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I was really shocked earlier this year on C-SPAN. There was this face of Scott McClellan's father who was appearing on the National Press Club with a book called something to the effect that LBJ was behind the killing of Kennedy. And I thought, what? Where is the tie-in between Scott McClellan, his father, and this guy in Texas who supposedly McClellan's dad was supposedly a former aide of LBJ's, and he said that LBJ was behind it. Now, I'd like to know what you think of that. I thought it was bogus,
yeah.
But I'd sure like to see you get on C-SPAN, Tom. You're so fantastic.
Well, Lamar is...
Also, I have one other question,
sure.
Since Dick got two questions, which I didn't agree with.
Okay. All right. Your other question.
My other question is, do you think that Haynes Johnson, I've always thought, wasn't he on Wall Street Week or Washington Week in Review?
Right. That's correct.
That guy has a lot of credibility to me because I watched him for years.
Yeah.
But
well, he won a Pulitzer Prize.
Right. And I just think, isn't it weird that Scott McClellan's dad is getting this airtime and maybe your book has more validity?
Well, I'd love to address
thank you,
the LBJ question.
Okay, thank you. I'll listen off the air.
Great,
thank you.
You.
You know, people look at LBJ because, of course, Kennedy was killed in Texas. But you need to keep in mind two things that our book makes really clear for the first time. JFK was only killed in Dallas, Texas, because the earlier attempts in Chicago on November 2nd and in Tampa on November 18th had been uncovered and foiled. So, you know, if those had gone well, JFK would not have been killed in Dallas. And Dallas has gotten a bad rap over the years. You know, sure, there were a lot of ultra-conservative people in Dallas, but when you look at the pictures that day of those crowds, they were huge. They were enthusiastic. You know, the people of Dallas, by and large, you know, they just turned out for JFK. So Dallas, in that respect, has gotten a bad rap, and Lyndon Johnson as well. Johnson was no saint, you know, I would be the first to say that. But he had no involvement with JFK's death. Dallas was not especially kind to Lyndon Johnson. In the 1960 campaign, Lyndon Johnson and Lady Bird were cornered in one of in Dallas's finest hotel, the Adolphus, and almost attacked by a crowd of conservative leading citizens of Dallas. So LBJ was considered way too liberal and progressive on civil rights for the leadership of Dallas.
Yeah,
so,
and the interesting thing about Johnson is his the story that Harry told us. I'm pretty sure you were with me there, Lamar, when Harry told us the story of his meeting with LBJ and Bobby right after the assassination. And I want to get to that in a minute. We actually have a caller who has a question about the escalation in Vietnam and its relationship to that. But first, I've got a few other people who have been on the line for literally an hour. Dave in Humboldt County, California, you're live and on the air. Hey, Dave.
Thank you, Tom. You touched upon my main issue, and that is that while mafiosos and Cubans might have their motivations for this assassination, they would have no means, certainly no significant means, to put in place the elaborate mechanisms that have been put in place to keep us misinformed about this. They would have no ability.
That's right. The cover-up was actually put into place by John and Robert Kennedy themselves, Dave, in the anticipation of blowback from their attempt to assassinate Castro. In other words, they were concerned that if Castro found out about this plan, it's the CIA codename for their piece of it, AM World, we call the C-Day operation, that if Castro found out about this, that he might try to do something. You know, he might be sufficiently angry that he would, you know, kill the governor of Louisiana or kill the U.S. ambassador to Mexico or something. And so Bobby and other people around him put together this it was called the Cuban Contingency Plan, this plan to basically, you know, cover everything up if Castro did that successfully. And that's the plan that was invoked when Jack was killed, because they weren't sure.
And caller, I would encourage you, you know, go in a bookstore, pick up our book, look on page 803, and you will see for the first time in any book a document you can get at the JFK Library or the National Archives from November the 12th. From one of Bobby's committees, and it says the subcommittee was assigned the preparation of contingency plans to counter the following possible actions by Castro, and number letter C item is attempts at assassination of American officials. And this is November 12th, just 10 days before Dallas. So what Tom is saying is correct. Much of what we call a cover-up and think some people think must have been spawned by some huge conspiracy, the thinking behind that was in effect well before JFK's death by the representatives of John and Bobby Kennedy.
Right. This was something the Kennedys put into place in the first place. Cliff in Seattle, Washington, you're live and on the air. Hey, Cliff.
Thank you for a stunning hour or an hour and a half so far of conversation about this. I'm just kind of quaking in my shoes here. Speaking of LBJ, there is supposedly a letter that he wrote that is not supposed to be opened until 50 years after his death. And I'm wondering if you conjectured that he might spill the beans about everything that you've been talking about.
You know, that particular letter, there are so many stories about those kinds of things, and some of them turn out to be, some of them true, some of them turn out not to be true. But again, what we can say conclusively, and this would apply to the Watergate era, you'll be shocked at how many people, a dozen people whose names are familiar to folks from Watergate, were involved in this secret coup plan of the Kennedys in the fall of 63.
To some extent, you could even speculate that Nixon was using these same people for the same reason, although you could also say he was going back to his old mob CIA connection guys.
Well, and in many ways, we just want to make the point that this plan almost came out several times in the last 40 years, Watergate being one of them. But so, you know, it's almost come out before, but a lot of things that you will hear and a lot of things that are still secret, like those 1 million CIA files, they are secret not because, the CIA or LBJ at the highest levels knowingly killed JFK, but because of secrecy related to this coup plan, you know, many parts of which are still secret. But we make as much public from declassified records and people who work with the Kennedys as we can. So I think even though those 1 million documents are secret, you'll have a pretty good idea what's in those documents after you read the book.
Just to give you a quick summary, then we've got to take a break, and then we'll be back with your phone calls. Ultimate Sacrifice, the book. In summary, John and Bobby Kennedy had a secret plan to overthrow Castro and invade Cuba on December 1st, 1963, that has has never been revealed before, and we lay it out in this book. And the secrecy around this plan is why there's still secrecy around the JFK assassination. Three mafia godfathers, under intense pressure from Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department, had infiltrated this plan, this coup plan against Castro. This was Johnny Roselli of Chicago, Santos Traficante of Tampa, and Carlos Marcello of Louisiana, Texas. And they used this first to try to kill Kennedy in Chicago on November 2nd, then in Tampa on November 18th, and finally successfully in Dallas on November 22nd. And the secrecy surrounding Kennedy's coup plan prevented any thorough investigation. In fact, it sparked a cover-up that the Kennedys themselves had prepared for. More on this when we come back. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, talking with Lamar Waldernick.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't know, y'all. We're in the real tough position in the midst of all these negative conditions.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Lamar Waldron, my co-author in the book Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the Plan for a Coup in Cuba and the Murder of John F. Kennedy. 1-866-440-8446. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Jim in Seattle, Washington, you're live and on the air. Hey, Jim.
Hey, my question is, if the mafia, you know, was so hot to get the Kennedys, why didn't they just get Bobby instead of the president? Would have probably been a lot easier.
Well, this goes to what Santo Traficante's lawyer told us. Lamar, why don't you?
Well, it actually goes back. In the summer of 1962, the mafia was planning to kill Bobby Kennedy. At that time, JFK had ended his relationship with Judith Campbell, who was quite very, very close to Johnny Roselli. So the mafia didn't even have that for potential blackmail. And so the mafia associate, Jimmy Hoffa, who was very, very close to Santo Traficante, shared a lawyer with him, Frank Regano, was making plans and talked about shooting Bobby riding in an open car in that summer. And, in fact, the FBI received an anonymous tip that when Bobby Kennedy went to Los Angeles in the summer of 1962, that he was going to be assassinated. Now, also involved with Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana at that time, was another woman having a relationship, or who had had a relationship with JFK, and that was Marilyn Monroe. And she was put in a very compromising position. You can find a lot of information about this in other books by Anthony Summers, but we put in a concise
kind of summarize it in this book, yeah.
And but once Marilyn Monroe died, you know, that she was no longer possible to blackmail the Kennedys that way. So by the fall of 1962, Traficante and Marcello are both talking to FBI informants, saying that to get rid of Bobby Kennedy, we have to kill John because, as Marcello said, if you have a
this is what Marcello this is what Marcello's lawyer. Now, I thought it was Traficante's lawyer.
Well, there are two different conversations, Tom.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Marcello's talking to this FBI informant, and he's saying, look, if you cut off the tail of the dog, in other words, Bobby Kennedy, the head of the dog is just going to turn around and bite you. In other words, JFK would send in the army, the National Guard, you know, to Marcello's compound. It wouldn't matter that Marcello controlled many officials in Louisiana. You know, the army would come in. But if you cut off the head of the dog, if you kill JFK, the tail, Bobby Kennedy, stops wagging. And everyone in the country, in a political sense, knew that Bobby and LBJ hated each other. So once JFK was dead, Bobby would essentially be powerless. So that's why
the target
was JFK and not Bobby.
Right, and that's what happened. Jim in Sacramento, California, you're live and on the air. Hey, Jim.
My name is Jim Hart, and I'm a Vietnam combat veteran. I joined the Navy prior to the Bay of Pigs. Got decorated for that, even though I was only going to school at the time. But I ended up going to combat in Vietnam with a secret clearance, learned a whole bunch of stuff, and the only thing I never did learn was why the hell we were there. And now I'm wondering if maybe it was a diversion, an attempt to divert the public's attention to the Vietnam era instead of the conflict, you know, the consideration about, you know, why was Kennedy killed, who killed him?
Well, there is, there actually is a connection here between the death of John Kennedy and the escalation of Vietnam. Lamar, why don't you take
Sure. And first I'd like to say, you know, admire, you know, all vets and everybody who served like
Yes.
that.
Yes, Jim, thank you for your service to our country.
Really. And you're going to hear some things that maybe will be new to you and help explain what Vietnam was about. Because what happened was Lyndon
Johnson a minute and a half here, Lamar.
Decided not to continue Bobby's plan. Bobby actually at a certain point did go to Lyndon Johnson in January of 64, wanted him to continue this coup plan. Lyndon refused because he hadn't been in on the plan.
He didn't even know about it.
Right, prior to JFK's death. So he refused to continue it. Now, certain parts of the plan were continued by the CIA and millions were spent, but there were really no serious efforts made. And it did take, if you think about it, it was over the Gulf of Tonkin incident was, I think, 8 months after that. And then we didn't really get a lot of combat troops going in for almost a year after that. But what it was, LBJ felt he had to make a stand against communism somewhere. It was not going to be against Cuba because, as he told aides, you know, he did not want another Bay of Pigs in the first few months of his administration. So as we now know, I mean, it's not like the Gulf of Tonkin incident was staged as much as a lot of miscommunication. And, you know, LBJ realized soon that that hadn't really
happened.
The bottom line
is that LBJ chose to make his stand against communism, which was the obligatory thing he had to do if you wanted to get elected in the 60s, in Vietnam rather than Cuba because they'd all been burned in Cuba. George in Tacoma, real quick question. We've got less than a minute left.
Okay, I was wondering, if you had two assassination attempts on him, why didn't the Secret Service insist he put that bulletproof top on the car?
Well, a quick answer to that is the bubble top that was used during inclement weather was not bulletproof. So, you know, that's a misconception a lot of people have. You know, from a good high-powered rifle, from not a great distance, that bubble top was not bulletproof. And remember, in Tampa, JFK, you know, was trying to show, you know, I'm strong, follow me, I'll back you in this coup. You know, so hiding behind a bubble top in Tampa or even in Dallas where they didn't know there was an active threat, that would not have sent the message JFK needed to send in the days before the coup.
Although the incredible thing is that in the Tampa motorcade, Kennedy actually knew that there were people out there trying to kill him and that they hadn't caught them yet.
Right, and there are photos of JFK in the Tampa motorcade, and almost as if to say, in case word had leaked that there was a threat and he wasn't afraid, JFK stood up in his limo through much of the Tampa motorcade.
Which is an incredibly painful thing for him to do, by the way.
Sure. But to me, the fact that he even did the motorcade, that's a very brave thing, you know, for the guy who helped to write Profiles in Courage.
So if you want to know more about it, the website, ultimatesacrificethebook.com.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, and Lamar Waldron is my co-author with this. Lamar, doing most of the work on actually putting the book together here over the last 10 years. Lamar and I, in the previous 7 years, worked together researching this, and I helped write the first draft of a fiction version of this, which is now we've had enough declassified documents and enough dead people that we can actually write it as nonfiction, which is such a huge relief. And so anyhow, Ultimate Sacrifice, the book. Lamar, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's a Tom Hartman radio program. We'll see you tomorrow. No, we'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.